had no choice but to return to the second-rate WCW. After that, it was time to go back home, back to his most loyal fans. And it was time to do everything he could to make the company competitive with McMahon's. Although Flair couldn't wrestle for several months due to a non-compete agreement with McMahon, he kept himself busy both on screen, in a non-wrestling segment entitled Flair for the Gold, alongside Wendy Barlow, a.k.a. Fifi the Maid, who 20 years later would become Flair's live-in girlfriend after his fourth divorce, and behind the scenes, eventually becoming the lead booker of the promotion. Regaining Flair convinced Ted Turner to open his wallet in an attempt to lure in more big names. It took nearly $500,000 to bring Sid Vicious back into the fold, a move many in the industry justified by the fact that he had main-evented WrestleMania less than a year earlier against Hulk Hogan. They also signed a British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith, to an inflated deal. A bit puzzling, seeing as he had been a mid-carder, as half of the British Bulldog's tag team, for most of his WWF career. He had main-evented exactly one pay-per-view, admittedly a huge success, as it drew over 80,000 fans to SummerSlam in 1992 at Wembley Stadium in London. But that was the catch. He was a star overseas, namely in his homeland, England. He had never drawn in the U.S., where WCW was promoting all of its shows. Not only did WCW begin to sign names, but at the advice of their pay-per-view head, Sharon Sidello, they also began to film expensive skits in an effort to sell their upcoming shows. These weren't cheap-looking productions filmed with standard television equipment. They were professionally filmed, and they looked like honest-to-God movies. And why not? They had the Turner family behind them, and if anyone could make such a production look high-end, it would be them. The only problem was that these skits were so horribly written and acted that the results were laughable, at best. Take, for instance, the showdown between Vader and his new nemesis, Cactus Jack, a.k.a. Mick Foley. The storyline for this one had already been set up by Vader and Jack's knockdown drag-out affair on WCW Saturday Night, the promotion's flagship show at the time. Vader pulled back the blue mats around the ring, exposing the concrete, and set up Jack for his powerbomb. Announcer Tony Schiavone, mortified, said if Vader executed the move, Jack would be killed. Well, he executed the move. Jack was not killed. That's the good news. The bad news is that even though Vader tried to let him down as gently as you can let a 300-pound man down on a 6-foot drop, Jack still smashed the back of his head on the concrete, giving him his second concussion in just over 2 weeks and leaving him with momentary loss of feeling in his limbs. With a setup like that, Pro Wrestling 101 says to just replay the bump over and over so fans will see Jack as a sympathetic character to get behind. Instead, an overblown backstory was created, in which Jack had amnesia, was locked up in a mental institution, which resulted in tons of angry letters sent to TBS from viewers who felt WCW was making fun of the mentally ill, believed he was a sailor who repaired bicycles for children, and was hunted down for weeks by a bogus news reporter. Foley truly hated the amnesia angle. When he came back to the ring, he attempted to salvage things by claiming this was all part of an elaborate ruse to play mind games with Vader. However, even after he said these things on TV, the announcers continued to play up his amnesia. This despite him saying that he didn't have amnesia. Contradictory storylines such as this would soon become commonplace in the company. Even though Lost in Cleveland, a mini-movie based on the amnesia angle, was a flop, WCW felt they were onto something and set forth plans for their next cinematic epic. This one was for Beach Blast, in which Davey Boy and Sting were slated to take on Vader and Sid. Standard wrestling booking says that to promote a tag match with the biggest heels in the company facing the good guys, you'd film the bad guys beating the crap out of the babyfaces in the ring. This sets up a scenario in which Sting and Davey would be seeking revenge, but they'd appear to face insurmountable odds in getting it. After all, they'd just been laid out by the guys they were confronting. How could they possibly win? Instead, fans were treated to Sting and Davey Boy playing volleyball with orphans on an island, and this is a direct quote, somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico. Vader and Sid showed up to crash the party, on a warboat, no less, and challenged the good guys to outdo them in a clam bake. No, just kidding. They challenged them to a match at Beach Blast. In the meantime, an evil one-eyed midget named Cheatham, yes, as in cheat them, planted a bomb on Sting's boat and blew it to smithereens as the heels had a good laugh. Let's look at the two scenarios we presented. Scenario one, in which the heels beat up the faces and leave them sprawled out in the ring, would have cost approximately $0 extra to film. Scenario two, the amazingly well-produced but equally amazingly poorly written and performed orphans slash warboat slash one-eyed midget slash boat explosion route wound up costing $80,000, more than double the $33,000 pay-per-view live gate. Both would likely have garnered the same results, as the buy rate for Beach Blast received no bump from the prior show, achieving a mere 0.5. There was so much negative feedback on the one-eyed midget skit that all replays were immediately canceled. The bigger story here is that there had been replays scheduled in the first place, as were all future episodes of Lost in Cleveland with Mick Foley. Things had gotten so bad by June that Ric Flair's first TV match back in WCW, teaming with Arn Anderson to take on Brian Pillman and Steve Austin at Clash of the Champions, drew just a 2.6 rating and 1.5 million homes, by far the least watched and lowest rated Clash of all time. As will be noted numerous times throughout this book, when wrestling is hot, you can make all sorts of mistakes and it'll take a long time to sink the ship, but when wrestling is cold, you can do all the right things, and it doesn't necessarily make any difference. Having lost so much money, WCW was looking for someone new to take the reins. Who better than third-string announcer Eric Bischoff? They wanted to get away from wrestling people, Bischoff noted in 2014. They wanted someone to run the company who understood the entertainment business, that wasn't so entrenched in wrestling that they were sucked into the politics of it. So I just threw my name into the hat. And that is how he became the boss. Well, he was kind of the boss. Since day one, unlike in the WWF with Vince McMahon, WCW never really had a boss. Bill Watts was, quote, the boss. But he wasn't the boss because it wasn't his company, it wasn't his money, and there were people above him who could have pulled the plug on him at any time. He was merely hired by a higher power to try to steer the ship in the right direction. All of this got worse after he was removed from power. A corporate structure was set up consisting of, no joke, nearly a dozen different people. And then they set up a booking committee that consisted of considerably more than a dozen people. Bischoff was the one who got the role of executive producer of WCW. And since WCW was largely about television and television ratings for Turner, he ended up the most powerful person in the day-to-day hierarchy. The boss, so to speak. In later years, this would be something commonly brought up by those who watched WCW's collapse, that there was no main boss. There was no Vince McMahon, who was the final voice, who had veto power, who was the overall leader of the company. Note, we said later years. When WCW was at its height, everyone knew who the boss was. It was Bischoff. However, after things started to collapse, this became a common theme, a recurring excuse. The fact that there was no main boss. Which begs the question, what happened to the leader that was there before? But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Bischoff had been in the industry for just a handful of years and had, in fact, been turned down for a job by the WWF in June of 1990. He learned the business from Vern Gagne, the man behind the American Wrestling Association, which, in its day, was a huge power in the pro wrestling business, operating primarily out of the Midwestern region of the United States. The company, around since the 1960s, had become so established that they eventually were able to ink a deal with ESPN, which gave them a daily show that reached millions of viewers. The American Wrestling Association played host to countless wrestling stars, but not unlike Ole Anderson, Vern made sure the spotlight always shone brightest on himself and a handful of his closest friends. Eventually, that wound up biting him in the ass, as the unthinkable happened. He got old. So did his chums. Tired of their geriatric antics, fans made it clear that they wanted to see some fresh faces. Vern was stubborn, though, and stuck to his guns, allowing men such as Hulk Hogan, Jesse Ventura, and the Road Warriors to slip right through his fingers. Even on the rare occasion that a newcomer was able to break through, said newcomer was usually a relative of one of the old guys, notably Kurt, Larry Hennig's son, and Vern's own son, Greg, a scrawny beanpole no one wanted to see in main events. By the time Bischoff arrived in the AWA, the promotion was on its deathbed. Attendance at shows had dipped so badly that Gagne opted not to run any more live arena events, taping his shows in an empty warehouse instead. Seeing the writing on the wall, Vern's top stars fled for other promotions. Bischoff stuck with the promotion until nearly the bitter end, before getting far enough behind on pay that he left to try out as an announcer for the WWF. He didn't get the job. He had, though, developed a taste for the business and had learned much under Gagne's tutelage. After Vince showed zero interest in him, he turned to WCW and was eventually given a shot as an announcer on lower-end shows. Like a sponge, Bischoff soaked up every bit of wisdom he could, not only from the wrestlers and the booking team, but also from the production people. Bischoff was smart enough to realize that there was more to wrestling than just what went on inside the ring. This paid off for him big time. Following the departure of Bill Watts, the company was looking for a new head honcho. At the time, many believed that the next boss would be Tony Schiavone, WCW's lead announcer at the time. Schiavone had, after all, been with the organization since before it was even known as WCW. He'd worked for Jim Crockett, not only as a wrestling announcer, but also as a baseball play-by-play man. If anyone was a lock for the job, many reasoned, it was him. But it didn't happen. Instead, Turner reps liked what they saw in Eric Bischoff. He was young, he was handsome, and he was aggressive. He had new ideas. And, perhaps most importantly, he also seemed to have a more corporate mentality to him, with an understanding of marketing that they found very appealing. In short, he knew more than just pro wrestling, and he was a far cry from the crotchety old ring warriors who had preceded him. Ole Anderson would start yelling at a moment's notice, but Bischoff? No way. He was far too level-headed, and perhaps for that reason more than any other, he was given the ball and told to run with it. Despite the artistic and commercial failures of the mini-movie ventures, Bischoff saw the value of having more control over the product he was presenting on screen. Therefore, the decision was made to forego most of the arena television tapings and instead begin to record shows at Disney MGM Studios, a theme park in Orlando, Florida. This would have the twofold effect of lowering costs, as they could tape several shows at once, and allowing the promotion to demonstrate to fans at home who was really popular and who was really hated in its ranks. To that end, WCW began to screen the crowds at these tapings, specifically filtering out any hardcore wrestling fans, since they would likely have their own opinions on different characters, opinions that wouldn't jive with what the company wanted to present. For example, Marcus Bagwell was a babyface many hardcore fans didn't care for, so they'd boo him on his way to the ring. WCW didn't want any of that, so they had signs to instruct folks when to cheer or boo, just like a standard television show. And, just like a normal TV show, they were taping months in advance. To Bischoff's credit, the tapings likely saved the company many thousands of dollars, which no doubt pleased his bosses in the Turner regime. However, this also forced the company to plan in advance, because they would tape 3 months' worth of shows at a time. Therefore, any title changes the company had, such as those at live pay-per-views or live Clash of the Champions specials, were to be factored into the production of the show. For example, when the tapings began, Barry Windham was the NWA champion, but later in the tapings, Ric Flair was the NWA champion. The match where the belt switched was not filmed since the title change was planned for later on at the Beach Blast event. Not only that, but the tapings also made it clear that Flair would drop the title shortly after winning it to Rick Rude. This made for some major headaches for WCW, such as when news of the changes was leaked to the fans. That happened, of course. However, since the internet was in its infancy, the only way fans really knew what was going to happen was through insider newsletters and WCW didn't consider that a big enough issue to be of real concern. No, the major dilemma was that once filming was done, WCW more or less had to follow through with their title changes. They had done this once before, in the early months of 1991, when matches were taped with the Fabulous Freebirds wearing the tag belts, despite the fact that they hadn't even won them yet. In fact, the Birds lost the belt to the Steiner Brothers all before they'd even actually won them in the first place. It didn't matter, because things would play out in order on TV. Since that scenario had turned out fine, WCW felt that the Orlando tapings would as well. But there were some major issues. One of the biggest was that the National Wrestling Alliance found out about upcoming NWA title switches at the tapings. Since the formation of the NWA, the main governing body had to vote on all upcoming title changes and approve them. So if a promoter wanted to put the NWA title on, say, Ronnie Garvin, the board would vote and say no unless they'd completely lost their minds. In 1993, WCW was still officially an NWA member. If you'll recall, in 1992, there was a big legal battle over the NWA title belt after Flair was fired from WCW without dropping the championship, and the belt itself subsequently showed up on WWF-TV in the hands of Bobby Heenan. It came out during the NWA versus WCW court battle in September 1993, that around that time, Bill Watts managed to convince the current NWA president, Seiji Sakaguchi of New Japan, to sell the physical belt to WCW for $28,000. During the sale, Watts and WCW were also granted intellectual rights to the NWA name. Apparently, most everyone else in the NWA was completely unaware of this, so when they tried to take WCW to court over their booking of the NWA Championship in 1993, WCW balked. The NWA's claim was that selling the intellectual rights to the NWA name was something that should only have occurred via a vote amongst the board of directors, which never happened. WCW ultimately broke all ties with the NWA on September 1 and continued booking the belt as they deemed fit. However, they had footage of Rude with the NWA World Championship belt bantering back and forth with Flair that they somehow had to factor into their programming. Since they could no longer promote the NWA world title by name, and all they had was this big gold belt, they just started promoting matches for the, quote, big gold belt. Imagine a judge with no knowledge of pro wrestling attempting to make sense of all of this. Another snafu caused by the tapings involved the WCW tag titles. The Hollywood Blondes, Steve Austin and Brian Pillman, were to drop their titles to the Horsemen, Arn Anderson and Paul Roma. At the tapings, it was revealed that the Blondes would do this at the Beach Blast show, but at the last minute, WCW decided to keep the belts on Pillman and Austin. They could do this because there was still a live Clash of the Champions event at which WCW would have the belt change hands. All great in theory, until Pillman was injured prior to the bout and couldn't work the show. A makeshift championship team of Austin and Steve Regal, who had never worked with Austin before and had no ties to the tag belts, defended and lost the belts to the Horsemen. For all the problems being created, everyone felt as though the pendulum was on the upswing, especially with the biggest show of the year, Starrcade, on the horizon. The event was to feature a match that had never been presented before, one that fans were looking forward to and were therefore willing to pay for the right to view. Vader versus Sid Vicious, with the WCW World title on the line. Again, the MGM tapings revealed the course of events. Sid, with the belt around his waist, was portrayed as a hero. This time, however, things really fell apart. During a tour of the UK, a fight broke out between Sid and Arn Anderson following a confrontation at a pub. Both had been drinking, and Vicious became boisterous. He started bragging that by threatening to not lose to Sting at Halloween Havoc, he'd forced the company to give him a $100,000 raise to approximately $600,000 per year over the next 4 years. And imagine signing someone with Sid Vicious' reputation to a 4-year deal. Meanwhile, he cackled, Arn's salary had been cut about $100,000 in a renegotiation with Watts before Watts was let go. He said this was fitting because it was time for guys like Flair and Arn, the old dinosaurs, to step aside so guys like himself could get the spotlight and make WCW great. Arn was good friends with Flair at the time. In later years, they had a falling out, and the argument escalated and almost came to blows. It was broken up, and both men were sent back to their rooms. A little later, Sid went to Arn's room, and a fight broke out. Exactly what happened and who started the fight depends on whose side of the story you want to believe. What is known is that in the brawl, Arn had a pair of blunt-tipped scissors, and Sid had the broken-off leg of a chair. Arn claimed Sid used the chair leg first. Sid ended up stabbed a few times. They got into a wrestling match. Sid got hold of the scissors, and he then proceeded to stab Arn head to toe. When it was broken up, Anderson was a bloody mess, with stab wounds everywhere, including very close to one of his eyes. The walls were destroyed and covered in blood, and glass was broken everywhere. It was a horrible mess. The incident got press all over the UK, although in most reports the men were listed as WWF wrestlers, and a little bit in the US and Canada. Sid had been scheduled to wrestle against and win the WCW title from Vader at Starrcade, but due to his injuries, that plan was scrapped. And ultimately, due to the belief that the whole thing was Sid's fault, the decision was made to fire him. In a cruel irony, because WCW had taped so much TV in advance, while they were suspended in real life, both Sid and Arn were on television most weeks, with Arn, no joke, constantly talking about having been stabbed in the back by the heels. And just like that, Sid, the man who was to lead the promotion into 1994 as champion, and who had already been taped doing so, was history. A mad scramble ensued to determine just who would wind up with the main event slot at the biggest show of the year against Vader, with Cactus Jack, Sting, and Rude at the top of the list. In the end, the company listened to the crowds at the WCW events. We want Flair. Billed as a match after which he'd retire forever if he lost, an emotional Flair beat Vader before 8,000 fans paying $65,000 in Charlotte's Independence Arena to regain his title. Yes, despite being too old for Jim Herd 3 years earlier, and of no further use to McMahon or the WWF, Flair was once again the man. The Flair vs. Vader match was one of the most memorable in the history of WCW. Flair did some of his best ever work on the mic, and the pay-per-view itself, a one-match show if there ever was one, was built entirely around the main event. The pay-per-view actually opened with what would today be likened to a UFC countdown special, where they showed images from Flair's childhood, adolescence, and college, interviewed him at home with his family, spoke to the other superstars as they arrived at the building, and more. The match was brutally stiff and hard-hitting, with Flair taking an epic beating. Well, they both did, before finally clipping Vader's knee and schoolboying him to win the championship. It remains one of the greatest moments of Rick's career. It was also the last major angle overseen, at least to a degree, by Dusty Rhodes, as after 3 years, he resigned as booker shortly thereafter. Overall, it was a pretty good time for all within the company. For whatever reason, the ratings started to turn around after hitting an all-time low for Flair's return tag match at The Clash. In August, they not only rebounded, but at a 3.4 rating and 8.7 share for an episode of WCW Saturday Night featuring a Flair vs. Sting 41-minute NWA title match, the best numbers for any pro wrestling show in the U.S. all year, and that includes Raw, and the best for WCW in several years. The year even ended on a great note, as Ted Turner, for the first time ever, called a meeting to address all of the wrestlers and front office staff, making it clear that TBS was going to support WCW across all of their various platforms. He loved wrestling, and as long as he was around, WCW would never go out of business. Everybody was very bullish heading into 1994. The happiness was short-lived, however, as Turner officials decided to look at the books to see just how well the company had done under Bischoff's leadership in the past year. No doubt his new style of promoting, along with his money-saving measures like filming the bulk of WCW programming at MGM, would pay huge dividends when the financials came out. But they didn't. Although TV ratings had increased slightly year to year, comparing November 1992 to November 1993, both house show attendance and revenue had dropped a staggering 70%, with your average live event drawing around 300 fans. The company was still losing money, a lot of it, and this was something Bischoff didn't want to be a part of. After all, if he could be the first man in WCW to actually turn a profit, he'd likely get even more power and money to do with as he pleased. They were close, so close, and he wasn't about to let his company slip away. After a week or so of intense soul-searching, Bischoff decided that the one thing WCW lacked was mainstream media attention. If they could just be accepted as the WWF's equal, the company would be set. Have we lost money? Yes, Mr. Turner, we have. But we can make it back tenfold. We just need a bit more time, a bit more money. We need to capture the attention of the casual fan, and I've got just the guy to do it. You've probably even heard of him. Hulk Hogan. Now there was something Ted could buy into, the biggest star the business had ever seen. With Turner's blessing, Bischoff, with a major assist from Ric Flair, who knew Hogan from their WWF days together, and who had taken over as booker after Dusty resigned, set out to catch the biggest fish in the pond and bring him home to Uncle Ted. The timing was perfect, because Hogan had left the WWF earlier in the year, following a blow-up with Vince McMahon over the way he was being booked. Hogan felt that he should still be the focal point of the company, the champion. McMahon disagreed, preferring to focus on younger guys such as Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, believing they would connect with a, quote, new generation of fans. The two got into a bitter argument following Hogan's title win at WrestleMania 9, as McMahon wanted Hogan to drop the belt to Hart and, quote, pass the torch in the process. Hogan, stuck in his 1980s mindset, refused, saying Hart was way too small and wasn't, quote, in his league. Instead, he put over the enormous Yokozuna at that year's King of the Ring pay-per-view, then disappeared from the company to pursue acting and wrestle the occasional big show in Japan. But there was room for Hulk Hogan's star to shine in WCW. If he wanted to be the top dog in the promotion, well, that was just fine. Hogan had, after all, drawn more money than anyone else in the history of the business. Just ask him, he'd tell you so. The only stumbling block was that Hogan wanted so much money, a contract larger than any contract WCW had ever offered before, including $300,000 per match, 25% of pay-per-view revenue above the WCW average, 25% of house show revenue for any show he worked, which wouldn't be many, and a whopping 65% of all merchandise revenue. Not only that, his WWF release stipulated that Vince McMahon had the right to match any offer Hogan was given from any other wrestling company. In other words, in order to ensure Vince didn't interfere with this deal, which was important given WCW was pushing Hogan very hard on TV, almost to the point of making him the centerpiece of the promotion before he'd signed any sort of deal, they'd have to offer him a lot of money. A lot, as in a lot, a lot, a lot. But Bischoff didn't care. It was Hogan or bust, and after convincing higher-ups in the company, namely Ted Turner himself, he got his wish. Despite Hogan signing, the new WCW still managed to find ways to be the old WCW, such as when they aired the wrong control center segment on the Sunday main event TV show. Doesn't sound like a big deal, except in this case, the wrong one was actually the one scheduled to air a week later after the next Clash of Champions. Thus, before the Clash took place, the control center revealed, among things, that Ric Flair had beaten Sting to become the Unified Heavyweight Champion, consisting of the WCW title and the Big Gold Belt. Oops! WCW actually acknowledged this snafu during the opening moments of the Clash show later in the week. They essentially claimed that Flair had doctored a tape and somehow, perhaps via Bobby Heenan, gotten it to play on TV to mess with Sting's head. Really. This did not explain how Flair, in doctoring the tape, also managed to predict all the other finishes that were given away as well. WCW's Hogan era began on June 11, 1994. His arrival was celebrated with an elaborate parade, complete with confetti, and sure enough, Hogan was booked as the number one contender and set his sights on current WCW champ Ric Flair, who, not surprisingly since he much preferred playing the bad guy, immediately began booking a slow heel turn for himself the moment he took over from Dusty Rhodes. Hogan easily conquered Flair at Bash at the Beach, selling out the Orlando Arena and doing a colossal 1.02 buy rate for the company, its biggest since 1991 and one of its largest ever. Going in, with the exception of Bischoff and a small handful of others, virtually every single person in the wrestling industry thought the idea that WCW could do a 1.0 buy rate with Hulk Hogan was completely preposterous. It was also very reassuring for the company, as Hogan had not moved TV numbers at all prior to this pay-per-view. The show where he debuted with the Confetti Parade did the same rating as a show a few weeks earlier had done with Flair versus Ricky Steamboat, and his live debut at the Clash of Champions on June 23rd saw that show do the fourth lowest Clash rating of all time. Upon Hogan's arrival, WCW had an entirely different look. The old Center Stage Theater, the longtime taping location for WCW Saturday Night, had been completely renovated. According to a source who worked for WCW at the time, Center Stage used to be a rat hole in the grossest part of Atlanta. Then, the first day Hogan came in, they put purple curtains up everywhere so you couldn't see how shitty it was. That very same day, went from coffee and water and Gatorade to fruit and all sorts of food. In the old days, when wrestlers walked out, they used to come out under the seats from the bleachers. You're kind of ducking a little to not hit your head. So, they put curtains up everywhere to hide things and try to make it look better than what it really was. Regardless, when the Bash buy rate came in, Bischoff breathed a sigh of relief. His investment had paid off. The company needed a 0.75 or so to break even on Hogan's new deal, and they easily exceeded that. And the fans were really starting to buy WCW as a true alternative to the WWF. It certainly helped that the week WCW debuted Hulk Hogan, WWF debuted, wait for it, a fake Undertaker, played by Brian Lee, a gimmick that died a death, no pun intended. With this promising start, maybe Bischoff thought, he could catch Vince. No maybes about it. He would catch Vince and even surpass him. Confidence was buoyed when the August 24 Clash of the Champions, headlined by the first ever free Ric Flair versus Hulk Hogan match on television, they never did a singles TV match in WWF during the early 90s, did a 6.7 rating and 4.126 million households for the main event, the all-time cable TV viewership record for a professional wrestling match in any company in United States history. With TV and pay-per-view success, Hogan was able to convince Bischoff that he held the key that would take WCW to the top of the mountain. His friends, all of whom coincidentally needed big paydays. So Randy Savage, Jim Duggan, Earthquake John Tenta, Honky Tonk Man, Jimmy Hart, and countless others were brought into the fold. Longtime WCW employees like Steve Austin, Vader, and Mick Foley were thrown into the background so as not to steal the limelight from Hogan and his pals. "I was thrilled to be there, don't get me wrong," recalled John Tenta. "Hulk really went to bat for me. But I was amazed by just how much money that company blew. Hogan would tell me about how he and Bischoff would go out for sushi and spend $1,000 in a single evening. They didn't care. It wasn't their money. It was Turner's." And then there was Ric Flair, the man who had done everything he could to repair WCW following his stint in the WWF. Bischoff quickly realized that there was no way Hogan and Flair could coexist at the top of the WCW mountain. Flair was a heel, and Hogan was supposed to be the tippy-top babyface, but Hogan had made appearances in Flair country and been booed out of the building, which was not what the company wanted. And it wasn't just in the Mid-Atlantic area. In, quote, neutral cities, such as Oakland, California, the response was about 50-50 for both guys. Flair was asked, well, told, to job to Hogan one more time in a retirement match at Halloween Havoc. At the time, the idea was that Flair would retire for a while, maybe a year or so, and then they'd shoot an angle for his return. From WCW's perspective, the retirement was never supposed to be permanent. First and foremost, it was done to try to hotshot a giant buy rate for Havoc, which would help boost revenue so that when the books were examined at the end of the year, all of the big money acquisitions, not the least of which was Hulk Hogan, would look like a wise investment. Flair did not want to retire, but when the idea was proposed, he claimed, and this is hilarious in hindsight here in the 21st century, that if he did this retirement angle, that was it. He was done, and he was never coming back to wrestling. Halloween Havoc with the Flair vs. Hogan retirement vs. retirement cage match stipulation, plus appearances by Mr. T and Muhammad Ali, was a cautious success, drawing a live gate just under their all-time record set at Baltimore Bash 1989, and another buy rate around 1.0. There were definite grumblings, however, that it only did roughly the same buy rate as Bash at the Beach, as there had been those in the cable industry predicting a 1.5 or higher, and a few WCW higher-ups predicting even higher, perhaps a 2.0. The show also drew less than 9,000 paid in the 21,000-seat Joe Louis Arena, certainly not befitting what was billed as one of the biggest matches of all time. But even with Hogan's cut, it wasn't a money loser, and it helped pad revenue for 1994. With Flair gone, WCW needed a new challenger for Hogan. This was set up in a post-match Havoc beatdown following the big leg drop of doom. Hogan's old buddy and longtime lackey Brutus the Barber Beefcake, Ed Leslie, teamed with the former Earthquake, John Tenta, to lay out the Hulkster and set up Hogan versus Beefcake, now the Butcher, for Starrcade. But something funny happened on the way to the event. The fans who had been so hot for the Hogan-Flair showdown suddenly lost interest in what Hogan was doing. And when the buy rates came in for Starrcade, the company was stunned. At 0.6, it was 40% lower than they'd done for Havoc just 2 months earlier. About the only good news was that the live event sold out, the first WCW sellout in years. But with Hogan's pay-per-view cut and a 0.6 buy rate, while still not a money loser, Starrcade became a financially unsuccessful event for the company. Obviously, Ed Leslie was no Ric Flair. Also on the show, another former WWF star made his live debut. Macho Man Randy Savage, one of the biggest stars of the 80s and a legitimate mainstream name, appeared after the Butcher match and teased attacking Hogan. Instead, the two teamed up and ran off all the heels before posing together in a celebratory manner. Savage, who had parted ways with WWF earlier in the year, had been Hogan's opponent at WrestleMania 5 on April 2, 1989 in Atlantic City, New Jersey. The Hogan vs. Savage storyline was among the best long-term storylines not only in WWF history, but in the history of wrestling. And after a year-long build that saw the Hogan and Savage Mega Powers tag team explode, leading to their title match, WrestleMania 5 had become the single most lucrative event in wrestling history. At the time of Savage's debut, the record still stood. Obviously, the long-term idea was to relive the glory days of the 80s with another Hogan vs. Savage feud, this time in WCW. While on the surface it appeared WCW was doing nothing but signing old men, the reality was that a lot of 80s WWF fans had lost interest in wrestling during the early 90s, and suddenly, in 1995, they slowly began to discover that the stars they grew up on were back wrestling again, just not in the WWF. It was also shortly around this time that a young wrestler named Jean-Paul Levesque decided to leave WCW and joined the WWF. He would be renamed Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and eventually the heir apparent to WWE upon marrying Vince McMahon's daughter, Stephanie. WCW continued to rebound in the opening months of 1995. They had barely made it to January when plans were put into motion to bring back the man who a few months earlier said that when he retired, he was never, ever coming back. The Nature Boy, Ric Flair. Hogan was moved into a feud with Vader. It just made sense since Vader had been the top heel of the company for the better part of the previous 3 years. The feud was a big business success, both at the house shows and on pay-per-view. The two battled it out at Super Brawl, which was the first WCW live event to draw over 10,000 paid fans since 1989, a 0.96 buy rate, and a DQ finish. And Uncensored, a goofy card featuring all gimmick matches, a 0.96 buy rate, foolish finish, where Hogan beat Vader in a strap match by dragging the now unretired Ric Flair to all four corners. Not kidding. At Slammarie, a 0.57 buy rate, Hogan and Savage beat Vader and Ric Flair in a tag match where you'll never guess who did the job. And at Bash at the Beach, a 0.82. It should be noted that the Bash show took place on a real live honest-to-goodness beach, which resulted in a real live honest-to-goodness gate of $0. The good news was at Bash at the Beach, with all those thousands of beachgoers there watching pro wrestling in the sand, estimated attendance was about 10 to 12,000 at the peak, so WCW claimed to get this hundreds of thousands, made it a news highlight on all the local Huntington Beach, California TV stations. The bad news was that most of them referred to it as a World Wrestling Federation event. While WCW was spending more than ever on talent, there was still pressure to cut costs in other areas. A number of longtime execs were fired, including Jim Barnett, who ended up back with the company a few years later as a, quote, talent scout, and Bob Dew, leaving Bischoff the number one go-to guy in the company under the new head of the division, Harvey Schiller. Don Sandifer, who booked buildings and worked as a promoter, was also fired and replaced by Gary Juster and Zane Breslov. Breslov, a former concert promoter who had worked for the WWF before jumping to WCW in 1993, would end up an unsung hero of the company during the glory days, becoming one of the best local promoters in the history of the business. He died tragically on June 20, 2003, in an automobile accident. On a business level, Zane had a lot of great ideas, Bischoff told Alex Marvez shortly after his passing. When it was rolling, I think we talked no less than 10 times a day. He had very good instinct. Often, when I wanted to try something, I would use Zane as a sounding board, because I could trust him and knew he was not just telling me what I wanted to hear. Despite the cuts, there were financial positives as well, not the least of which was the decision early in the year to move to 9 pay-per-views annually and raise the price to as much as $32.50 the day of the show, up from $24.95. The price increase was an immediate success as it made WCW Uncensored, which drew a 0.96 buy rate, the biggest money show in WCW history. At the time, the question was whether too many pay-per-views would oversaturate the market. At the end of the day, and this is still the case in the 21st century, the optimum number of pay-per-views has been 1 per month, no more, no less. And increasing the number in the mid-90s ultimately resulted in both WWF and WCW making significantly more money than they ever had before. In fact, moving to monthly full-priced pay-per-views, they had started with discounted 2-hour in-your-house events, was what first took WWF from losing $4.4 million in 1994 and 1995 to becoming financially solvent a year later. With the business once again looking promising, on June 5, 1995, Bischoff and Turner had yet another meeting, and this time, Ted had a question. Why, he wondered, was WCW Saturday Night not beating Monday Night Raw? The shows were very close in the ratings at the time. If they had Hogan, Savage, and all the other top stars. Bischoff said that Raw aired on Monday nights, a better television night than Saturdays. Which was funny since wrestling had a long and storied history of excellent viewership on Saturday, and had the benefit of sometimes going live. Turner, who was already pissed off at McMahon, since Vince had been sending him letters for the past year telling him his promotion was an embarrassment to him and that he should shut it down, immediately told a supervisor to give Eric 1 hour of live programming every Monday night on TNT. In other words, WCW would be competing directly against the WWF's flagship show, Monday Night Raw. Bischoff was elated. He had just been given the go-ahead to fight Vince McMahon mano a mano, and now he had to deliver the goods. At the end of 3 years, he said in a press conference a few weeks before the Nitro debut, I will be standing alone. Within the industry, most thought Bischoff was insane to try to run head-to-head with Monday Night Raw, which was, despite WWE's financial difficulties, the number one pro wrestling show at the time. But Bischoff believed something that few others did. WCW could beat McMahon by changing wrestling forever. Which is pretty much exactly what WCW Monday Nitro did when it debuted on Turner Network Television the night of September 4, 1995, a week in which Raw was not so coincidentally preempted. The years-old formula of wrestling shows consisting primarily of squash matches flew right out the window. In its place were big-name versus big-name showdowns, something reserved for pay-per-views in the past. Shocking happenings, such as Lex Luger suddenly defecting from the WWF, began occurring on an almost weekly basis. Fans soon learned that if you miss Nitro, by God, you can miss a lot, and it became the show to watch on Monday nights. Luger jumped the WWF ship for WCW Monday Nitro's first episode. Although it had been known by those within wrestling that he'd negotiated with WCW a few weeks earlier, the belief was that he could not come to terms with the company only offering him a $1,000 per shot guarantee. Still, one would have thought that Vince McMahon would have either attempted to sign him to a new deal or refused to book him in a prominent position on his TV if he did not have a contract. But McMahon did neither, and Luger made a deal with WCW. They kept the deal a secret and hid Luger backstage during the first Nitro, so that when he walked out in the middle of the Hulk Hogan versus Big Bubba Rogers main event, wrestlers within both companies were stunned. Luger, it should be noted, was not brought in by Eric Bischoff, but rather his best friend. Sting brokered the deal. We were having a casual conversation, and he asked me how much time I had left on my contract. I said, I don't have one. And he said, what are you talking about? I gave my 90-day notice back in December of the year prior, 1994. I told him I was basically week to week or month to month right now. He said, you've got to be kidding me. So he contacted Eric, and Eric Bischoff at the time wasn't a real big Lex Luger fan. I thought he was an arrogant ass, Bischoff noted. But I guess he felt I had enough of a name that maybe I could have some momentum for Monday Nitro. I had a conversation with Eric, who decided to go ahead and reel me in. Unfortunately, he had a stipulation that no one could know except for he and I and Sting. And I had a problem with that because I was raised to professionally give at least a 2-week notice. But Eric really wanted this to be a surprise. I literally finished up in WWF on Sunday night at a house show in a tag match against Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon. And the following night, I flew home to Atlanta, got right on a plane, and flew to Minneapolis that afternoon. They hid me in a hotel. Then they brought me to the building with a towel on my head. About an hour before I was going to go out, they brought me out to the position to go on TV from a side door, and no one knew I was going on until the moment I was standing at the go position. And then I was watching Hogan in the ring. It was a pretty wild turn of events over 2 weeks, especially those last few days. September 11, 1995 was the real beginning of the Monday Night Wars, as it was the day that Raw and Nitro went head-to-head for the first time. The belief among many was that there was a finite number of wrestling fans, and that if the two shows aired on the same day at the same time, the audience would split, with a portion continuing to watch Raw and another portion choosing to watch Nitro. But that is not what happened. Instead, Raw and Nitro did 2.2 and 2.5 ratings respectively. Not only were more people watching pro wrestling on Monday nights than at any point in the past several years, but Nitro, the upstart television show encroaching on WWF's established Monday night territory, actually won the head-to-head ratings battle. Furthermore, although Turner had only authorized 1 hour live, he'd actually given the company 2 hours of programming. A Monday Nitro replay drew a 0.9 rating. In other words, despite Raw having established a very successful foothold on Monday nights, the very first time the companies battled it out, Nitro was seen by significantly more viewers. Lesson not learned. One important point that was completely ignored 15 years later, when TNA Impact Wrestling tried to go head-to-head with Raw, is that it's not like this WCW audience sprung up out of nowhere strictly due to the fact that wrestling was going head-to-head on Monday nights. In fact, WCW had several successful weekend shows at the time, and in fact, on the week of September 11, 1995, WCW Saturday Night had done a 2.3 rating, and WCW Main Event a 2.0, numbers that destroyed WWF weekly programming. Impact had nothing approaching these numbers when they decided to run head-to-head with Raw in early 2011, nor did they have anything approaching WCW's level of talent or financial resources. Perhaps most importantly, WWE wasn't asleep at the wheel in 2011 like WWF was in 1995. In the beginning, both WWF and WCW had completely different mindsets about what it meant to go head-to-head. McMahon's WWF had traditionally built a bubble around itself, not acknowledging non-WWF promotions, champions, wrestlers, etc., with only very rare exceptions, the most notable being when the real world champion, Ric Flair, jumped to WWF in 1991, but even then, there was no acknowledgement of the NWA, WCW, etc. Although they were now going head-to-head with WCW on Monday nights, they decided to operate as if they were not going head-to-head, there was no competition, and that it was business as usual. Eric Bischoff, on the other hand, was out for blood. Since the September 11 Raw show was a taped show, where Shawn Michaels beat Sid, Eric flat-out revealed to the Nitro audience that you shouldn't bother turning the channel because Raw was taped, and Shawn Michaels, quote, beats the big guy with a superkick that wouldn't have earned him a green belt at the local karate school. He talked about how Lex Luger had jumped ship from WWF 9 days earlier, and that he was tired of competing in the Bush Leagues and wanted to be where the big boys played. While there had been bitter head-to-head territorial wrestling wars in the past, nothing like this had ever been done on national television before. And this was only the beginning. Bischoff installed a monitor under his announcing desk so that when the two shows went head-to-head live, he could actually watch Raw, see what was happening, and book Nitro changes on the fly. 4 days after the first ever head-to-head meeting, WCW fired one of their performers who had been on the DL with a torn triceps. The Hogan clique hadn't been a big fan of this guy because he had a high-paying deal that they felt was unjustified. He was a good worker, but he didn't have any particular special charisma. His name was Steve Austin. In hindsight, September 1995 was one of the most pivotal months in the entire history of professional wrestling, as three things happened that helped change the course of the business forever. Nitro debuted, which ultimately led to the Monday Night Wars and the greatest worldwide boom period in wrestling history. WCW also fired the performer who, more than any other, was ultimately responsible for the rebirth of the WWF, the turnaround in the wrestling war, and the creation of Vince McMahon as a certified billionaire with the resources to keep his company alive for decades to come. And, that very same month, it was announced that Turner Broadcasting was merging with Time Warner to create the single largest media conglomerate on Earth. While some in WCW will confuse the impact this had on the fate of WCW, the reality is that this merger, and that with AOL a few years later, ultimately turned WCW into a company that needed to carry its weight financially, something it had never had to worry about before, and when it couldn't, that did, in fact, lead to its demise. With the wrestling war picking up, Vince McMahon called a meeting with talent to introduce a new company booker, Bill Watts. Yep, same Watts. Watts buried WCW, talking about how the corporate structure within the company made it impossible to get anything done, and predicting, shockingly accurately as it turned out, that the Time Warner merger would ultimately result in Ted Turner losing the power to save WCW, and that TBS would drop the company. McMahon said WCW made a stupid business decision going head-to-head with Raw, as opposed to putting the show on a different night of the week, and said WWF didn't have the resources to go live like Turner's company did. He brought up a talking point that he would stick with for years, that this was a personal battle between himself and Ted Turner, a billionaire with significantly more assets, which stemmed from the fact that Turner had tried to buy the WWF 10 years earlier and had been turned down. While McMahon overstated the issue between the two, largely because by making Turner out to be an evil billionaire trying to take out the mom-and-pop WWF business, he painted himself as a sympathetic babyface to his talent. There were some personal issues there, but they more than likely stemmed from a letter McMahon wrote to Turner a few years earlier, telling him that his wrestling company was a joke, and that he should be embarrassed and ashamed and shut it down. Watts, it should be noted, lasted 3 weeks before calling it quits. Vince had told Watts he would have creative control and wouldn't be overruled on his decisions. Vince proceeded to immediately overrule him, and that was all she wrote. Going into October of 1995, Raw and Nitro were at a dead heat. Forgotten in history is the fact that, at least for a while, WWF was airing a Raw replay on Thursday nights. Adding in the rating for that show, Raw was being watched by more people, but it was an unfair head-to-head comparison. Ultimately, the replay was dropped, because at the end of the day, the only numbers that anyone really cared about were those head-to-head Monday ratings. And the feeling was that by eliminating the Thursday show, it would convince people to watch on Mondays instead. Over the next 15 years, as Raw became the flagship show in professional wrestling, they never aired a full-length replay out of fear that it would erode the audience. In the 2000s and 2010s, they aired Raw on Saturday mornings, which was only 1 hour, and their Hulu feed of the show was also edited down to 90 minutes from the original 3-hour airing. Ratings remained head-to-head throughout October despite WCW booking an angle where a mummy debuted, bursting forth from a giant block of ice in a Nitro main event segment. It helped that on the other channel, Diesel, the WWF champion, was being booed unmercifully despite McMahon's efforts to make him the new 1980s-style Hulk Hogan babyface champion. Speaking of Hulk Hogan, he lost his WCW title at the Halloween Havoc pay-per-view in a match with a young newcomer named Paul White. White, who was named The Giant, was a legitimate near-seven-footer who, at the start of his career, was billed as the son of Andre the Giant. This was his first ever match on national television, and what a debut it was. Hogan was leaving to film a movie, so they needed to get the title off of him, but he was Hulk Hogan, and the idea that he would lose clean or put someone over was preposterous. So the stipulations for the match, kind of, more later, was that the belt could change hands via DQ, which is exactly what happened after interference from Jimmy Hart. The match itself was set up with an angle earlier in the show that we are not making up. The pay-per-view took place at the Cobo Arena in Detroit, Michigan. Prior to the Randy Savage vs. Lex Luger semi-main, Hogan and Giant had a monster truck battle on the roof of the building. It is believed the idea was that they would have a sumo match in these gigantic, and we do mean gigantic, monster trucks. Of course, it's pro wrestling, so they ultimately got out of the trucks, started fighting, and in the melee, the Giant, get ready, was pushed off Cobo Hall, falling to his apparent death. One would assume this would have resulted in no main event wrestling match taking place. But one would be incorrect in that assumption. In fact, Giant came out for his match with Hogan none the worse for wear. You see, although Cobo Hall was planted smack dab in the middle of a cement parking lot surrounding it on all sides, the claim was that Giant had fallen off the roof into Lake Michigan, and thus he survived and made it back inside 20 minutes later for his match. You'd think if you were going to book an angle so preposterous, you'd at least make sure Giant came to the ring sopping wet. But no, he was dry. Then they had their match. After it was over, the guy in the mummy outfit ran in. This man, Ron Rees, was called the Yeti, which Tony Schiavone pronounced Yeti for some reason. A Yeti, for those unaware, is an abominable snowman, the Bigfoot of the Himalayas. Why he was dressed up as a mummy is anyone's guess. He then proceeded, and if you think this visual is preposterous, we're telling you that the real thing was even more ridiculous than your imagination suggests, to bear hug Hogan from behind, while Giant simultaneously bear hugged him from the front. They double humped him. Don't blame us, we're just reporting the facts. That's what happened. Hogan was left in a heap, understandably. And the Giant won the title. At least until the next week on Nitro, when it was ruled that he was no longer the champion. The storyline was that Hart